Okay, welcome to this Middle East Forum event. Can everybody hear me? Okay, my name is Scott Rosenblum, and I'm a member of the Forum's New York Board and a partner in the law firm of Kramer, Levin, Eftaus, and Frankel, your host. It's my great pleasure to introduce Stephen Rosen, who will discuss wishful thinking in Iran, new governments in Israel, and the United States. First, a few words about the Forum, the think tank founded by Daniel Pipes in 1994. The mission of the Forum is to define and promote American interests in the Middle East and help the United States defend itself at home. Hallmarks of our mission include fighting radical Islam rather than terrorism, supporting democracy, and working for Palestinian acceptance of Israel. Our projects include the Middle East Quarterly, which offers an authoritative interpretation of Middle East affairs, Campus Watch, which exposes extremism and bias in Middle East studies, Islamist Watch, which combats nonviolent radical Islamic activities, the Legal Project, which provides legal aid for anti-Islamist researchers and activists in danger of having their free speech curtailed, and the MEF Educational Fund, which supports underfunded scholars and organizations researching the Middle East and Islam. In addition, today's event is part of a lecture series that we present in five cities. Also worth mentioning, the Forum's four websites attract over 400,000 visitors a month, the largest of any organization in our subject area. I invite you to add your name to the email list at this event to receive MEF materials. For more information on our current activities, please visit our website. I hope you will consider supporting the Middle East Forum financially. As a not-for-profit organization, we rely on tax-deductible contributions. I ask now that you switch off all cell phones and pagers, and please hold your questions and comments until the question and answer session led by the Forum's director, Daniel Pipes, which will take place after Mr. Rosen's formal remarks. Please limit yourself during the question and answer period to questions related to the topic of today's talk, since questions seem many times to wander away from topic. And now about our speaker. Stephen Rosen received a PhD from Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Diplomacy and has served on the faculties of Brandeis University, the Australian National University, and the University of Pittsburgh. He co-authored The Logic of International Relations in 1977, a best-selling textbook. Steve served as Deputy Director of the National Security Strategies Program for the RAND Corporation before joining the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in 1982, where he worked as Director of Foreign Policy at AIPAC until 2005. While at AIPAC, Mr. Rosen gained a reputation as a Washington insider. He was instrumental in persuading the Clinton administration to pursue a strategy of graduated economic sanctions against Iran, a plan formalized under the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act of 1996. Mr. Rosen's accomplishments at AIPAC were widely recognized. For example, National Public Radio called him a, quote, larger-than-life figure who helped shape AIPAC into one of the most powerful lobby groups in the country. In his very first public address since leaving AIPAC, Mr. Rosen will today offer his insights about choices facing the new U.S. administration vis-a-vis the Iranian nuclear buildup and the implications for U.S.-Israel relations. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Stephen Rosen. Make sure.
Thank you, Scott. And is this loud enough? Excuse me. Can you hear me in the far end? It's a challenging room.
It is a funny room.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Scott, and thanks to Kramer Levin for your hospitality, and thanks especially to the Middle East Forum. I have been an admirer of the Middle East Forum since its founding, I suppose, a little more than a decade ago, and especially its director, Dan Pipes. I think pound for pound and dollar for dollar, it probably has the greatest impact of any of the many organizations that try to keep the United States in a clear policy in the Middle East. And it's a great pleasure to be here today and to have a relationship with Dan in the Middle East Forum. The Obama administration comes to power as the issue of Iran reaches a climactic point. I was personally deeply engaged with this 15 years ago, and at that time, it was difficult to get people to even think about it. Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. The United States was gripped with peace fever between Israelis and Palestinians. Iran was a very secondary issue. And at that time, it was relatively few of us working for a program of graduated sanctions and pressures against Iran in order to prevent what we're seeing now, and that is the advent of a nuclear Iran and a situation in which the most radical country in the Middle East, that is the number one sponsor of state terror in the world, according to the State Department, year after year, and that has played a key role in the destabilization of Lebanon and of the Palestinian Authority and of Iraq, and even as trouble makes trouble in Afghanistan, where supposedly its interests are somewhat aligned with those of the United States, that this most dangerous of countries, the principal exporter of Islamic extremism, would reach the point that we seem to have or are on our way to reaching. And this is coinciding with the advent of a new administration in the United States. This was the first presidential election since 1979, or at least since the one between Reagan and Carter, in which Iran played a central role. And as you well remember, there were sharp differences expressed between Obama and McCain about Iran. And President-elect Obama felt very strongly that the past administration had missed a diplomatic opportunity to resolve issues with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and that a more ambitious and courageous program of diplomacy had the potential to achieve some sort of a breakthrough. And McCain made a strong case against Obama's point of view, but in the end, the American people made Obama president. And so we have the confluence of these two events, the problem of Iran reaching a climax, and an incoming president who has a particular commitment to a new approach toward Iran, a promise to the American people that he's going to do things differently. But what I would like to do with you for a few minutes today, and before we turn to a open discussion, is to lay out some thoughts about, to try to construct with you what I think President Obama is going to face when he sits down with his top advisors to actually review the opportunities and dangers that he is going to face in this effort to have a new diplomacy toward Iran. The Obama team is going to have five broad strategic options, the same five options that would have been available to McCain. Many of them they will reject out of hand. They will have the option of seeking regime change in Iran, the idea of bringing down the Islamic Republic, helping to foment a revolution or counter-revolution in Iran to support democracy forces and to try to bring the regime down. That is a difficult proposition. The government of Israel has flirted with the idea. The Bush administration flirted with the idea. There are some experts who believe that the Iranian regime faces a large-scale dissent and unhappiness, and that there is some some path to a successful revolution, but they are in a minority. They are in a minority in Israel. They were in a minority in the Bush administration. They will be in a disappearingly small minority in an Obama administration. I'll make you a flat prediction. They will not be able to persuade President Obama that there is an achievable path to bringing down the Islamic Republic. They were not able to persuade George Bush. They were not able to persuade Sharon. I doubt that they will be able to persuade Obama. Regime change will be taken off the table. As a matter of fact, taking regime change off the table, even as an option, is one of the ways that Obama is likely to distinguish himself from Bush. Bush's policy was schizophrenic. She went back and forth between what they call behavior change and regime change. And his critics sometimes point to this as not only logically inconsistent, but also something that undermined Bush's diplomacy toward Iran, that if he hadn't threatened them with regime change, that they wouldn't have been as defensive, so the argument goes. So regime change, the first of the five options, will be taken off the table early. At the other end of the spectrum, there are academicians who've started to whisper, and some of them to say out loud, a nuclear Iran is inevitable. Let's learn to live with it. There are other countries with nuclear weapons that we wish didn't have nuclear weapons. We can deter Iran. We can contain Iran. Whatever other mistakes President Obama might make, this is not one that he has made. He spoke very forcefully and repeatedly, including just 2 days ago, to say that a nuclear Iran would be a mortal danger to Israel, to the United States, to Iran's regional allies, its Arab allies. Iran has territorial disputes with several of its neighbors. And he has stated very forcefully that a nuclear Iran would be unacceptable. As a matter of fact, he used even stronger words in his speech to AIPAC. He said, I will do everything in my power. Everything in my power, that was his emphasis, to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. Everything. All of those interjections were his interjections. And he did that on national television in front of the world. So I don't think an advisor who comes to President Obama and says a nuclear Iran is inevitable, let's live with a nuclear Iran, will, at least in the first instance, get a hearing. Like regime change, this option will be taken off the table early. There is short of regime change, the option of surgical military strikes, we'll come back to this later, of special operations to try forcibly to set Iran's nuclear program back. It's conceivable that after some period of evolution, an option like that might get a hearing, but I don't think in the first instance it will succeed in even being taken as a discussable element of policy. Because the incoming team is full of hope about the theory that diplomacy with Iran, and for that matter elsewhere in the world, hasn't been tried, that the previous administration was unilateralist, they think, and did not work with allies. The previous administration had excessive faith in the use of force and insufficient faith in talking to people, dialogue, communication, engagement. And they are going to reject the idea of the early use of force. We're already fighting two wars, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. Our armed forces are exposed. They are the larder is bare. We are overextended. There are many practical problems. It is not going to be taken as a serious option in the first instance. So we're left with two remaining options. And these two, which are related to each other, are where I predict the new administration is at least in the first instance going to go. One is carrots and the other is sticks. And the carrots are the ones that their attention will turn to first, because they think the Bush team was too harsh. And they will be looking for new things to put on the table with the Iranians, new inducements that might bring about a change in Iran's own calculus of its self-interest. New ways to test Iranian intentions. But also enhanced sticks. Their belief is that the last administration was unilateralist, as I said. And they believe that by working more closely with allies, we could get more cooperation for economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran. More sanctions against Iran. More cooperation on sanctions against Iran. In fact, they believe, and this is a key point, they believe that these two matters are related. They think that the last administration failed to get cooperation on sticks because it was unwilling to put on the table carrots. They think that the Allies were unhappy with the United States because it would not talk to the Iranians, it would not offer the Iranians inducements, and that had the last administration been willing to do that, it would have gotten more cooperation on sticks. Because we have a little bit of a paradox here. Most of the remaining, the United States has used, except for military ones, just about all of our pressure points against Iran have already been employed. But the Europeans have not used all the pressures, and the Japanese, and certainly the Russians and the Chinese, have not used all the pressure points that they could use. So the sticks belong to the Allies, the remaining unused sticks, but the remaining unused carrots belong to the United States. If we were to offer taking the economic sanctions off the table, the carrot is no more stick. If we were to offer a normalization of investment and trade opportunities for Iran, we could revolutionize the Iranian economy very quickly. Do you know that today's Iran produces 4 million barrels of oil a day? The last day of the Shah, he produced, that's in 1979, 6.5 million barrels. More than what would that be, 50% more. And today, Iran consumes half of the oil it produces for its own population. At that time, it consumed very little. Population was smaller and less developed. So today's Iran exports 1.5 million barrels a day. The Shah's Iran exported 6 million barrels a day, four times as much. This is an amazing fact. Iran's oil production, and even more so its gas production, could be increased exponentially if there were an end of American economic sanctions. This is the carrot I was talking about earlier. We have a big carrot that we could use. Which brings me to the phrase, the potential for a grand bargain. The new vernacular in Washington is, let's offer the Iranians a grand bargain. The grand bargain is, if you say yes, if you will suspend enrichment of uranium, if you will admit international inspection in obtrusive forms that will really provide some security about what you're up to, if you will end your support for terror in Lebanon, in Hamas, in the West Bank, in Gaza, with Hezbollah on a global scale, if you will stop the attacks or fomenting attacks against American forces in Iraq and to some extent in Afghanistan, then we will put everything on the table, including the kitchen sink. And we will not hold back anything. We're prepared for a revolution in our policy, too. And we will actually help you improve your economy on a revolutionary scale. There are very few countries in the world who are in a position to help as much as Iran, even given the current economic constraints. Because what we have to do for Iran is not foreign aid. It's not grant aid, it's not gifts, it's not unilateral subventions. All we have to do in the case of Iran is to lift barriers that are preventing them from using their own resources with our help and our technology. It could actually be a win-win situation. There are some who say that it would be a mistake to engage with Iran on the basis of grand bargain. There are others even in Israel, who say, well, why not? You know, as Colin Powell once said, the reason we put people on terror lists is to take them off terror lists later, to get them to stop engaging in terror and nuclear proliferation and the rest. We put them on lists, but the objective of putting people on lists is not to ostracize them for eternity just for the sake of it. The purpose is to get them to alter their behavior and take them back off the list and change the sanctions and eliminate the sanctions. And even inside ILSA, the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act, and the various other American sanctions, there are sunset clauses that provide right in the statute or the reg that if the Iranians were to change and stop their nuclear program and stop the terror and so on and so forth, then we would end these sanctions. It's right in the statutes. I know, we wrote them. So it's not that exotic an idea. I think you'll find that in Israel, even the most hardline people, they may doubt that Iran would agree to a grand bargain and live up to a grand bargain. But if one were really possible, there's no conceptual objection to responding in this way. Although I ought to put in a caveat here. For the human rights advocates, for those whose primary focus is the lack of democracy in Iran, for those who are concerned primarily about justice in Iran for the people of Iran, this whole line of argument will be less compelling. Because the sad fact is that if they were to end their nuclear program and they were to end the terror and they were to end the rest of the international misbehavior, they might still be tormenting their own population and conducting themselves on the basis of massive injustice at home. So there is a contradiction between the focus on internal justice in Iran on the one side and Iran's international behavior on the other, at least in the realm of theory. So, President Obama is going to find that his advisors are coming to him primarily with ideas about bigger carrots and bigger sticks. It's clear that he thinks that the last administration didn't talk to Iran. Throughout his campaign, he spoke of this theory that, you know, you don't talk only to your friends, you have to talk to your adversaries, you can't get anywhere unless you talk to people, and all of this stuff about communication and dialogue. I think he's going to be a little surprised. That's why I circulated this piece of paper that you all have in front of you. He's going to be a little surprised when he looks at the actual record of diplomacy to discover that the Bush administration was deeply engaged with Iran in communication and dialogue for the entire 8 years it was in power. I've actually gone to the trouble of listing, going all the way back to the very beginning of the Bush administration, meetings at the level of ambassador and above between American officials and Iranian officials. One of the most dramatic was just in July, a few months ago, when the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Bill Burns, met with the chief Iranian nuclear negotiator in a delegation along with Solana, the chief European negotiator, United Nations, people from the IAEA. We were at the table, and we were at the table on the basis of a package that was being offered to the Iranians that included many carrots. Iran was offered a robust a civil nuclear program with international support to provide, if they claim they need nuclear electrical energy, to provide nuclear electrical energy on an unprecedented scale, and even to give them access to participate in a recycling program, albeit not on Iranian soil, for nuclear fuels. Iran has said no. Another thing to bear in mind is that Obama is going to be looking at an Iranian election. The President Obama will be sworn in on the 20th of January, and on the 10th of June, just months later, You know, it takes an incoming administration 3 or 4 months just to find out where the bathrooms are located. It will take a while for all of its officials to be confirmed and be put in place and get their own staffs and the deputy assistants and the deputies to them and the office directors. And by the time they get themselves organized, there's going to be an election in Iran. President Ahmadinejad clearly intends to run again. He will be up against at least one major rival, Larjani, who is the speaker of the Majlis, their parliament, and a former nuclear negotiator, and who himself is very close to the supreme leader. A lot of Iran watchers who know Iran better than I do claim that Larjani may be able to defeat Ahmadinejad. There may also be some other rivals for the position. A little difficult to tell who will be allowed to run. Under the Iranian regime, the Council of Guardians exercises a veto over the ability of candidates to put themselves forward. And you sometimes don't know until the last minute who will be allowed to stand as a candidate. So it's difficult to predict with precision just what the Iranian election will look like. But a lot of Iran watchers think that the current guy is on his way out or might be on his way out. And that will certainly be a hope in the mind of President Obama, because Ahmadinejad has been uniquely unpopular in the West. He's a Holocaust denier. His entire policy is summarized in the phrase, spit in your eye. He's been particularly defiant. Larjani is described as a pragmatist. In Israel, they say the difference between Ahmadinejad and Larjani is that Ahmadinejad wants to spit in your eye and Larjani wants to smoke in your eye. But there's no question Larjani will be smoother, probably less confrontational in his rhetoric, more open to communication and dialogue, and there will be enhanced feeling that there's an opening here that we ought to test. We have a new Iranian president. Who knows for sure what Iran's response will be? All the more reason to test. So my prediction is that there will be a fresh initiative toward Iran. It will be in the range of bigger carrots and bigger sticks and the search for a grand bargain. And it will be aimed at the hopefully non-Ahmadinejad incoming president, very likely or very possibly Larjani. And it will take place in the summer of 09 or early fall of 09, a year from now. Just a few more points. I don't want to go on too long. Leave time for an exchange. Obama's going to discover the limits of diplomacy, too. He's going to find, as I've already laid out, that the idea of dialogue with Iran is not nearly as new and blindingly original as he thinks it is, that it's been tried, and that it generally has not had good results. You know, Madeleine Albright, a decade ago, September of 1998, made a big speech in which she talked about an opening with Iran, and she apologized for our past history of American abuses toward Iran, and she offered Iran fresh carrots, admission to the World Trade Organization, which Iran supposedly craved, and some spare parts for these Boeing aircraft that have been sitting there lacking spare parts, which Iran also supposedly wanted badly. By the way, 10 years have passed. Iran has withdrawn its application to the World Trade Organization ever since we said yes, and it has declined Boeing's repeated offer to ship the spare parts at discounted prices and all of that. It doesn't want the Boeing parts. They've been making a point of saying no to these carrots. So that's not particularly encouraging. But Obama will also discover that there already is an offer on the table that the United States signed on to. It's the so-called EU3 package that offers a trade of Iran suspending its enrichment of nuclear fuel in exchange for variety of concessions that would take place immediately just for suspension, and that Iran hasn't agreed to this. It's going to be an immediate problem for Obama. Are we going to push the Europeans aside? Up till now, we've allowed the EU3, that's Britain, France, and Germany, the big three of the EU, and their foreign ministers to take the lead with the United States in a support role. They would like us at the table. Do they want us at the table instead of them? Won't that be the opposite of what President Obama said? He talked about Bush unilateralism and Obama multilateralism, but maybe Bush wasn't so unilateral. You know, it could end up with a reverse logic. And another problem he's going to face is the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, the Arabs. Just yesterday, there was a meeting of the quartet with representatives of, I think it was, seven Arab countries, and one of the main things the Arabs brought up, the foreign ministers at a very high level, was that they had been excluded from the EU3 initiative, that they are more worried about Iran, they said, than the West is. And they want to know what's going on, and they don't want any softening of the American and European position toward Iran. They want it to be tough. Well, they may not greet this new diplomacy by the incoming American administration with enthusiasm. They may greet it with concern. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Jordan has been particularly concerned about the so-called Shiite crescent that's being created with Iran at its center. How not to alarm Israel? 2 days ago, Tzipi Livni, the Israeli foreign minister, and as you know, one of the contenders to be prime minister in the election that Israel is also having on February 10th, said that she thought it would be a mistake for the United States to start a new dialogue with Iran at this time. It was a little unusual. Some people criticized her for being so overt in her opposition to the new American president. But she expressed doubt. She said she feared it would send a signal of weakness. And she's particularly worried that Obama will lift the condition of a suspension of enrichment. You know, he talks about negotiations without preconditions. But the EU initiative has been built on one primary precondition, which is the suspension of enrichment. Will this dialogue that the new administration is talking about take place without Iranian suspension? If so, it undermines an initiative that's already on the table to which the U.S. is a signatory, a multilateral initiative. So he's going to face a very serious conceptual issue right off the top. It could have the effect of weakening the sanctions coalition exactly at the time that the U.S. needs more international cooperation for enhanced sanctions. Those are the bigger sticks. The theory, as I said earlier, is that by us putting more carrots on the table, they'll be willing to put more sticks on the table, and we'll be able to offer the Iranians a sharper choice that has a greater chance of inducing a change in Iranian behavior. But if we do so in a manner that takes sticks off the table, well, then it's counterproductive right from the start. Well, let me jump over some of the things I was going to say to conclude with this. I'm going to predict to you that President Obama is going to be disappointed in the results he's going to get in Iran. Some of the members of his own team have already said so. The current scuttlebutt in Washington is going to keep Bob Gates as his Secretary of Defense. He hasn't said that, but his chief defense advisor, Danzig, did say that he thought Obama might do that. That's led to an expectation in Washington. That's what lies ahead. Well, let me read to you briefly what Bob Gates said about Iran. Let me remind you that Bob Gates was at the table as the note taker in the most important American-Iranian negotiations that ever took place. At the time of the fall of the Shah, Bob Gates went with Brzezinski to meet with the Iranian foreign minister The American National Security Advisor met with the Iranian Foreign Minister to try to make a deal, and the note taker was a guy named Gates. Gates said, he said this on September 29th of this year, "I've been involved in the search for the elusive Iranian moderate for 30 years. Each administration since then has reached out to the Iranians in one way or another, and all have failed." This is Gates, Iran's probable defense secretary. But the reality is the Iranian leadership has been consistently unyielding over a long period of time in response to repeated overtures from the United States about having a different and better kind of relationship. Until the Iranians decide they want to take a different approach to the rest of the world, where we are is probably not a bad place, he said. Well, where we are is a bad place, because if Iran does not respond to an offer, and if their strategy remains one of just stringing it out, we are, pick your number, is it 12 months, is it 24 months, or is it 48 months, from Iran crossing the nuclear threshold, an irreversible historical transition. We are coming to a very stark endgame. So I think the prediction I will close on is that we are going to see a diplomatic effort. It is going to fail, and the real question is, how long will it be allowed to take before we declare failure, and when we declare failure, what's next? Thanks very much again.
Thank you, Steve, for your knowledgeable and incisive talk, and you really laid out the steps. I would like to bring up two topics you didn't mention. One is an Israeli initiative, and the other is a Bush administration initiative. What about the next 2.5 months?
There was a belief that that the Bush administration would do something directly about the Iranian nuclear program before leaving office. I'm skeptical. Nobody knows. Watch me be wrong. I don't see any sign of it. I don't think they're going to do it. They've got 140,000 troops in exposed positions in Iraq. They've got a discredited president who the American people have just spoken and in rather a vivid manner. They are tired. They're internally divided. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mullins, has spoken out against it. It's tough to do something like that against your chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Others in the general staff have talked out against it. We are gasping for air in Afghanistan. As far as Israel is concerned, you also
before
have...
Before we move on to Israel, can I just ask you to repeat for this audience what you told me about your trip to Israel in early 1981?
Yeah. Well, just to show you how prescient I am, the year is 1981. The fellow's name is Steve Rosen, that's me. I led a RAND Corporation delegation to Israel, and I was focused on one question, and that was the Iraqi nuclear program. I met with a fellow named David Ivry. He was the chief of staff of the Israeli Air Force with the RAND delegation. And I asked him very pointedly, and everybody else we met with in Israel, in classified discussions, do you have a hard option against the Iraqi nuclear program? And David Ivry looked at me, and he looked at me like it was the most bizarre question I could have come up with. I just kind of shook his head like, you know, who knows, and so on. So I went back and wrote the official trip report. Israel doesn't have a hard option against the Iraqi nuclear program. And 2 months later, this is why Dan is doing this to me, you know, just to show you what a far-seeing guy I am. 2 months later, the undoable was done. So, yes, you're absolutely right. But I don't think I'm going to be wrong the second time. I don't see it. And I don't see Israel doing it either. One of the disturbing things, and this is one man's opinion, is that I see divisions in the Israeli general staff. There's a lot of wishful thinking, in my opinion, about deals via Syria, to pry Syria away from Iran, and to somehow get European economic pressure on Iran, and more among military people than among the civilians, a kind of last-ditch hope that something will save us from this black-and-white choice that we're trying to avoid.
So you, in short, the reason you didn't mention it in your formal presentation is because you don't think there's anything going to happen on either front.
Not in the next 2.5 months. But I think maybe we should spend a few minutes talking about what happens after a diplomatic initiative.
I'll leave that for the audience to raise. Anybody like to start? Have a...
Hi, Mr. Rosen. You talked about the carrots that the U.S. could offer, and spoke about how we might, you know, put forth this grand bargain, everything but the kitchen sink. I'm wondering, is carving up Israel the kitchen sink, and can we hope that that doesn't become part of the grand bargain?
Well, will we sacrifice Israel? The question is, what if we put everything on the table, including the kitchen sink, is part of the kitchen sink trading away Israel? There is the danger, you know, Israel's focus is more narrow. The United States, after all, has very broad issues with Iraq. We're very worried about Iranian policy in Iraq. We're worried about Iranian policy in Afghanistan. We're worried about Iranian policy in Lebanon, where, by the way, there's also going to be an election, that one in May, and it looks like the Hezbollah will be taking over Lebanon, a horrific development that's a rich subject in itself. And we're worried about Iranian policy in many other places. Israel is not indifferent. We're worried about Iranian policy on the Arabian Peninsula toward Bahrain and toward the UAE and elsewhere. Israel is on America's side about the whole list, but Israel has one overweening interest, which is the Iranian nuclear program. Now, in fairness, Obama's focus is also the Iranian nuclear program. My own guess is that actually, if there were to be some sacrificing of interests in an effort to induce a change in Iranian behavior, it's more likely than the other direction, that we would tolerate Iranian misbehavior in other spheres in exchange for concessions on the nuclear file. But there is the danger of the opposite, that Israel's specific interests would be sacrificed. But that will become much more acute when the diplomatic outreach fails. Then, if we were down to one choice and one choice only, and everybody knew exactly what that choice was, you either bomb them or you learn to live with the Iranian nuclear weapon. There is going to be, and this, in my opinion, is where we're headed. It is going to be a real time of testing. What will the policy of Barack Obama be? What will the policy of Joe Biden be? If John Kerry is Secretary of State, as a lot of the WAGs seem to think, what will the policy of John Kerry be? Do they have the guts to have a third war? What will the policy of Tzipi Livni be? What will the policy of Bibi Netanyahu be? There are lots of reasons not to do this. Let me remind you of some. It's not as if this is a simple, clean, cost-free option. You face the danger that even after you knock out an Iranian program, there's a crash program to rebuild. Now, it's true you can knock it out a second time, but most of the experts who've looked at the question do not believe we can eliminate the Iranian nuclear program by force. What we can do is to set it back by a somewhat uncertain length of time. The notional period is 5 years, but you might have to do this thing every 5 years. What if they withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty? What if we no longer have any inspections there? Today, a certain amount of what we know, some of the intelligence we have about the things we have to hit militarily, comes from inspections that they have allowed to occur. We would have less information. What if we lose Allied cooperation on sanctions against Iran? It's pretty weak already. In the aftermath of a unilateral strike by Israel or by the United States, what would their reaction be? What about the danger of attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq or in Afghanistan? As we all know, Iran operates through these intermediaries, all these disavowable cutouts that they have. They're in a position to do a great deal of harm to Americans. What about the Hezbollah in Lebanon, which now has 40,000 rockets and missiles aimed at Israel? 40,000. It had 7,000 when Israel withdrew from Lebanon. It has 40,000 today. And their ranges are longer. Their payloads are larger. Their accuracy is greater. And they're starting to introduce irregular warheads of special weapons. What about the danger of strengthening the Iranian regime at home, where on a wave of nationalism, it gets even more hard line than it is. I could go on. Closing the Straits of Hormuz, not very likely, but a possibility. But attacks on the Arabian Peninsula. There is, in general, a list of things that are very unpleasant to contemplate. Me, I would do it anyway, because I think most of these things won't happen, but we could walk through them individually. But it's definitely a daunting enterprise if you're Tzipi Livni, or you're Bibi Netanyahu, or you're Barack Obama, and somebody comes to you and says, here's the reasons not to do this thing. It takes real guts. And who's going to have that kind of... For Israel, there's an added deterrent, one more thing, Dan, and that is that the United States today controls Iran's airspace.
Iran.
Well, Iran, too. American Air Force now has air superiority over the entire region, something we've had to establish in order to conduct the war. You can't enter Iranian airspace without being detected by American radars. Probably long before you get there. I'm not saying the United States Air Force is going to shoot you down, but I am saying that the United States can't pretend it didn't know. This creates a dilemma both for the United States and Israel. A unilateral Israeli strike is something, if the U.S. didn't give a green light to, we still let it happen. And Israel knows that the U.S. will be seen to have let it happen. It's an added disincentive for Israel. Personally, I don't think any one of these is equal to the danger of Iranian nuclearization, but I think that we are not talking about a short list here. This is a sobering proposition.
Yeah, could you just walk through your scenario, name this out for a second. What would, and you can keep it short and leave the rest of the board, and what would an Iranian, a nuclear look like?
The question, if you couldn't hear it, we have a challenging shaped table, was what would an Iranian nuclear Iran look like from our perspective? Well, first of all, Doves have made a major point that Iran doesn't have a single unified government. Iran has multiple centers of power. When the Iranian Revolutionary Guards take over British naval vessels and capture British sailors, the Iran apologists rush to assure us that the Supreme Leader knew nothing about it and that this is just an uncontrollable faction of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, or the Basij, or this one, or that one, or the Iranian intelligence apparatus, which is not under central control. Well, these so-called reassurances are going to look a little different in a nuclear Iran, where we have to wonder who exactly is it that controls this Iranian nuclear weapon? Who controls these Iranian radiological materials? Who controls the Iranian missiles? When we talk about Iran, who exactly are we talking about? Is Iran a multi-headed monster with all of these factions that nobody can coordinate, each one crazier than the other. The long-term trends in Iran are not positive. The Revolutionary Guards have gotten stronger. They control more of the economy. They control more political positions. They are more numerous. The militancy is on the rise in Iran, not decline. So the first problem we're going to face is, who do we mean when we say a nuclear Iran? Who exactly is nuclear in Iran? And are they people you can even find, let alone talk to? The second question we're going to face is, what is the danger that we're protecting ourselves from? Is it a premeditated, methodical, systematic attack, for example, a strike on Israel, or a strike on Saudi Arabia, or a strike in Iraq against U.S. forces? Or is it something below that? Is it radiological materials planted in the heart of Tel Aviv that make it impossible to conduct life and commerce in that city, because they are, you know, a radiological bomb is a conventional explosive wrapped with radiological material wrapped around it to spread radioactivity without a nuclear explosion, for example, or to poison the water supply. There's just a wide range of options. To whom will it be further proliferated? Are you confident that the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, for example, will not give it to the Hezbollah, the Lebanese Hezbollah, the Hezbollah on the Arabian Peninsula, the Hezbollah in Brooklyn? Where does it go from there? What about the demonstration effect of an Iranian nuclear weapon? Is Saudi Arabia then going to feel secure that it can depend on an American deterrent? This is the same United States which said, we will not accept, it's unacceptable, I will do everything in my power, everything, I mean everything. And then, the next day, we just decided to live with it. And then we say to them, well, you better not use it against Israel or we'll hit you back. Is that believable? Is the United States going to be willing to see New York hit in order to save Tel Aviv? Is it a credible threat? What about the possibility of sub-nuclear aggression? You remember that when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, an oil-producing country, and we had the entire world with us, and a vote, a war powers resolution, authorization of the use of force, vote took place in the United States Senate in 1991, the vote was 52-47. What if Saddam Hussein, in other words, if only five senators had gone the other way, we would not have been able to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Kuwait would belong to Iraq today, along with pieces of Saudi Arabia. If only five senators changed their position, well, what if Saddam Hussein, instead of attacking the day he did it, waited 12 months? We now know he was only 12 months away from his first explosive nuclear device. Wouldn't that have changed the minds of five senators in the United States Senate? What about a vote that takes place 5 months from now or 5 years from now? After the experience we've just had, where Hillary Clinton was defeated in the Democratic primaries, partly because she voted the wrong way, and Barack Obama, had he voted, would have voted, quote, the right way, in other words, voted against authorization for the use of force in Iraq, aren't Democrats going to be more reluctant to vote for a use of force resolution in the future? And what if they're looking for a vote to dislodge an Iran with nuclear weapons from the foothold it has grabbed in Bahrain, for example? The Iranian army or navy has invaded Bahrain. We're going to drive them out? I don't think so. So sub-nuclear aggression, further proliferation, the dispersion of nuclear materials, and yes, direct attack. There is a camp in Iran that believes that Dan would be much more competent to comment on this than myself, but the return of the Mahdi depends on action that we can take, but we have to be willing to make great sacrifices. And Rafsanjani, who is not considered the hardest liner in Iran, spoke openly that Israel cannot live with one nuclear weapon. We can. We can survive it.
Could you say a word or two about electromagnetic pulse, EMP?
EMP is the use of a nuclear weapon to destroy the entire electronic system on which modern commerce and depends. you can list really 100 uses of nuclear weapons that are different from the notional scenario of a nuclear attack, outright nuclear attack, ways in which nuclear capability can be used. We're in a, personally, I think that the most important question, not only the United States, not only Israel, but the human race faces, is the advent of a nuclear Iran will transform the entire world indelibly and permanently for our children and their children. This is really the beginning of an age of darkness.
The scenario that you think is most likely.
We've run out of time. But very quick question, quick answer.
Is that the renegotiation at some point of time we're realizing that getting what he needs will be a moment of truth. But that presupposes that we have our finger on the pulse of the development of the Iranian nuclear program. Historically, the U.S. has spectacularly overestimated the time from the Soviet Union up to Pakistan to North Korea it takes to get caught. Isn't the more likely scenario negotiations will drag out, one morning we'll wake up and the program will be finished?
Well, the question was, what if we're underestimating? We have a history of underestimating how long it will take the Iranians. I certainly agree with you. We have to assume the worst case here. We could be wrong, but we should be assuming the worst case. And their strategy is clearly to run out the clock. Ahmadinejad is so dumb, he doesn't want to put smoke in our eyes. More dangerous is the guy, Larjani, let's call him, who does want to put smoke in our eyes and pretend to be negotiating seriously for 1, 2, 3 years, and especially because the use of force against the Iranian nuclear program is such a daunting idea, as long as there is the faintest glimmer of hope, the tendency to wishful thinking will be, they will play on our desire to think that all problems can be solved. One of the great faults we have as a country is to think that all problems can be solved. That just by talking to people, just through dialogue and engagement, we could, that everybody's reasonable like us, that the world is made of people who really want, that you have children, I have children, why don't we just make a deal, is a very American way to look at it, and it's in a phrase, naive, when you're dealing with people of this character.
Thank you so much, Steve, for what is perhaps the most pessimistic talk we've ever sponsored, but a very realistic one, and we're grateful for your knowledge and understanding of this, and glad you're on this case. Delighted to be your first host in some years to have you public speak for us. I thank you all for joining us. And look forward to seeing you at our next meeting. Thank you again to Scott Rosenblum and Kramer Levin for hosting us so generously at its offices.